Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
I love that. My favorite part always.
Do I get to do that?
You can do that at the end.
Okay.
You can do
it. All right.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Joe Garofoli. I'm a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I write for our politics blog there at sfgate.com. And tonight, we are joined by Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie, the authors of The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Nick is editor-in-chief of Reason TV and Reason.com, and Matt is editor of the print edition of Reason. And tonight, they're going to give us some libertarian solutions to some of America's most pressing problems. We're going to solve them all tonight, right?
Excellent.
Yeah. Okay.
And we should be out of here by, I'd say, about 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Yeah. Excellent. It only takes a quick look at the headlines of the latest news about the nation's debt to know that our country's political system is in a hopeless rut of partisan gridlock. Nearly every level of government, America is hindered by what the boys call the duopoly of Republicans and Democrats. And voters are frustrated, too. Public approval of Republicans at all-time high, and Democrats aren't far behind. And here in California, there's a record number of voters, slightly more than 20%, who are registered as declined to state. They're not Republicans, they're not Democrats. In fact, there's probably a lot of people in this room. And CNN recently published a poll last month that said 63% of voters said government was doing too much. That's up from 52% in 2008. Same poll also found that 50% of the respondents said government shouldn't favor one set of values. That's up from 41% 3 years ago. As our guests write, Republicans and Democrats have about, quote, as much governing difference between them as Fidel and Raul Castro. Add it all up, the authors say.
Yeah,
we are about to have a libertarian moment. Now, Matt's a California guy, is born and raised in Long Beach, and Nick is from New Jersey, born in Brooklyn. And tonight, we welcome them to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Let's get started. Now, first of all, before we get going, why don't you define for us, in your words, what libertarianism is?
Yeah, you take this one, obviously.
Anybody back here? I think the easiest way to do it is not quite precisely, but, a libertarian is somebody who is fiscally conservative and socially liberal. That's one way to think about it. Reason Magazine for years has talked about being in favor of free minds and free markets, kind of the idea that the individual matters most and that economic and civil liberties are conjoined. You really can't have one without the other. Another way, just to throw it out there, is that Matt and I like to define libertarian as an adjective rather than a noun. Instead of, how many of you have taken the world's smallest political quiz? Okay, and surprisingly, I'm sure, it's, I don't want to, really ruin it for you, but it's rigged so that you're always kind of in the libertarian quadrant unless you're Fidel or Raul Castro or John Boehner or Harry Reid or something. But, being a libertarian is not necessarily checking off, here are 10 policies that you agree with, so you're a libertarian. It's more, it's an impulse. It's a pre-political impulse that informs the choices that you're interested in making, and it's more as your default setting, should the individual have more or less opportunity to kind of control their own destiny, to, have choices that are meaningful to them. And that may not always be the final answer that you give in a situation, but if that's what you keep coming back to, you just might be a libertarian.
And now, why is this a libertarian moment? Haven't we kind of had these moments in history before? What makes this the libertarian moment?
A couple of different factors. One is, as we mentioned in the book, kind of the premise is that independents have never really been as large of a political bloc as they are right now. According to the Pew Research Center in their most recent look at this, independence, and this is like affiliation. So who do you sort of feel like? Do you feel like a Democrat? Do you feel like a Republican? Do you feel like an independent? Independents are 37%. Democrats are like 31 or something like that, and the Republicans are 29. Gallup poll, same thing. Independents are now the largest block of self-identified people. That's we are doing now into politics what we've done everywhere else in our lives, which is reject every brand with the possible exception of Apple Computer. We don't have we don't live in like Chevy families or GM families anymore like we did when I was growing up. These things don't make sense to us anymore. We tailor it to our own individual needs, and so politics more and more it's like the local newspaper. We want to unbundle it. And I'm sorry to
that's all right.
You've been living with it.
We've been unbundled many times.
Yeah, that's right. It never gets easier. First you cry.
But yeah, we want to have that experience, and it doesn't make sense to us as much anymore as it used to, you know, why should we tether fiscal conservatism or the idea that we shouldn't be growing government and over-regulating thing with the notion that we got to make sure that gay people can't get married. I mean, it kind of doesn't really make sense, these coalitions and these kind of tents. So people are defecting from that, which is a important precondition to things, because that gets you out of the tribalist mindset, which says that in 2011, by God, we got to raise the debt ceiling, but in 2006, by God, we got to not raise the debt ceiling because it depends on who's in power. So that's a great precondition for it all. And also, especially people who are younger than Nick, they...
I was actually born in 1922.
Yeah.
So. You look good. You look really good.
Thank you.
They've been born and raised on the internet on some level. I mean, been swimming in markets where choice is the default, where there isn't a lot of people telling you what to do, despite the fears of many people that, you know, AOL Time Warner was going to crush us like a bug. That didn't really turn out that way. So these are important preconditions. And as importantly, right now, we have with the two major parties, it's not that they're the same party, but once they're in power, they tend to perpetuate the same policies, whether it's intervention war, drug war, these types of things. Education policy is kind of indistinguishable at the practical level there. And these are some of the areas that are the most intractable in American politics, and people are getting that. And they're also getting that the solution to break that up comes from outside politics and not within politics, using the neat stuff that we learn in our kind of non-governmental lives and our online lives and
cultural lives.
Yeah, and you know the poll numbers that you quoted earlier in the introductory remarks from Gallup and CNN, you know, we're at record highs of people saying, you know what, the government shouldn't favor one set of values over others, mm-hmm. and that the government is doing too much. I think the actual question was, do you think the government is doing too many things that individuals and businesses should be doing? And so you stack that up, and people like Nate Silver, the Statsmeister, who's actually talked about, we discuss him in our chapter about the disorganization men, you know, say, hey, you know what, libertarians, you know, independents matter more than ever. Independents are a larger chunk of independents, hence libertarians matter more. But the most important thing is that politics is a lagging indicator of American society. It's, you know, it's the Mr. T on the A-team. It's the last one to get the joke. And it's come into politics. We have, you know, we have discombobulated and disintermediated all aspects of our lives where, you know, we no longer have to go to the cable company and get, you know, in order to get Comedy Central, you got to take 10 channels you don't want. We're not putting up with that. And this is what's coming to. So the libertarian moment, we're already in it in our cultural lives, in our personal lives, in our work lives, where we tailor situations to what we want. And now it's coming to politics.
And just the last cherry on that is there has been a huge gap since the fall of 2008 when George W. Bush got up in front of America and said, normally I believe in capitalism, but ever since that moment, all of the kind of bailout economics...
So you're talking about the 2008 bailout.
Yes.
TARP. Yeah.
Which are effectively bipartisan policies of bailing out the auto industry. All that stuff has been, with the exception of cash for clunkers, which people recognize as a way to get free money, has all been hysterically unpopular. Not just kind of unpopular, we're not really sure, but hysterically unpopular. And so when there's that gap, you can't sustain that. It's a dynamic moment right now.
And if we're trying to run the clock out now. We've got about an hour and
you
15 minutes.
You can't stop this audience. They will rush the stage.
But because I was told that we're trying to speak to an under 40 crowd, I'm going to use an outdated musical reference and say, you know, politicians have bigger butts than Sir Mix-a-Lot. So,
I like big butts, and I don't know why.
It's an uncomfortable.
There we go.
People are laughing as they're pinching their chairs backwards to the door. But
So we were talking about, you said there had to be defections. Yeah. And in California, 20% of the Californians, we said, were declined estates, and that's increased from 15% in 2003. Now, at the same time, the Republican Party has dropped, registrations dropped 5%.
Wait, there's a Republican Party in California?
Yes, by name, yes, there is. It makes you think that independents kind of just like pissed off Republicans who like to smoke dope, or what does that mean?
That's, you know, first off, you say that like it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Yeah.
There's a series of like polarization studies, which for a long time said independents basically track the ideological makeup of people who are betrothed to Democrats and Republicans. There's the same number of liberals, conservatives, and whatever. But that has started to split over the last 5 years. That is now getting different. The independent bloc is much more explicitly libertarian. And at the same time, the libertarians are much more explicitly independent. Back before the end of the Cold War, when it made more sense for libertarians to affiliate with the anti-commies in the Republican Party, libertarians sort of self-identified, voted 70%, 69% for Republican presidential candidates. Now, after the end of the Cold War, that's down to like 46%. And if you look at more recent vintage and what's happening on college campuses, Ron Paul supporters, only 38% of them voted for John McCain, which is super interesting. And according to the Pew survey, which just now has identified for the first time a typology which they describe as libertarian, a new kind of political category is large enough to classify it as such, said something like 65, 75% of people who are libertarian in their brains are independent. They have no, they probably lean rightward in the current
they're
context.
They're truly independent, yeah. Truly politically independent.
Much more independent than they were before. So that is a new thing.
And there's also evidence that the term libertarian is going to be used in the revision of the DSM of psychological disorders as well.
Yes.
So, you know, we're everywhere.
Hey, you guys. Talk a little bit about, you guys are for limited intervention overseas, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All opposed to the U.S.
Wars. Well, you know what? Let's put it this way. We're for limited military intervention.
Military intervention,
overseas,
yes.
And targeted,
yes.
Ones. Let's have more interaction and more globalization in terms of trade, in terms of the crossing of services, of goods, and especially of people. This is, the problem with North Korea isn't that they don't have enough government spending as a percentage of GDP. It's that they don't have enough interaction with the rest of the world. And, you know, this is one of the problems with that I think is a very powerful critique of military interventionism. A lot of times libertarians are tarred with the idea, oh, you're isolationists, you're cranks or whatever. And it's like that. It's not that at all. There's a need for a strong defense and a military that can support, you know, defend America and support our interests. But really, the main thing is we need more trade, and you know, everybody gains from trade, and we need more movement. It's and I'll stop with this, but it's a shame that Europe, of all places, could put together an EU where people, labor could move, circulate freely in the Eurozone, and we had NAFTA, overwhelming success, and yet we're showing ID'd across the Canadian border. For God's sake, that's
and,
a problem.
And part of the military critique or the foreign the interventionist critique is just that it's really gone very far in one direction, and that in direction is all more military bases, more involvements. If we think there might be a massacre in some city that we didn't even know existed until about 10 weeks ago, we need to intervene now. I mean, we need to like roll back from that. Can't afford it. We're out of money. For one thing, but
so what would you guys do to the and I know you have problems with the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the appropriate response to 9/11 would have been?
Well, first and foremost, in terms of foreign intervention, you know, there's no reason to believe that the civil liberties issues that were raised or that were kind of restrictions on various things and government spying that was authorized by the Patriot Act have done a lot to help. I mean, we have been spending billions and trillions of dollars over the years on military intelligence and whatnot, and that's good. You know, that makes some sense. It's not clear that the Patriot Act helped us get Osama bin Laden, 1,000 years after 9/11. I think we were right to ask Afghanistan, the Taliban government, we knew he was there. We said, turn him over, and if you don't, we're coming after you. And when the Taliban balked at that, it made sense to go in there. The question was, by the time they lost the trail of bin Laden, they didn't know what they were doing. We still, Obama had, who tripled ultimately the number of troops there, never was able to give a justification for what the mission was there and what the objective was. You know, when we're still there, that's the problem. So, you know, in terms of 9/11, I think we did in many ways the right thing, and then it just went into a kind of
the initial
shuffle.
Right thing, going into Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Right.
And Iraq is a totally separate issue. I mean, it's a non sequitur, effectively, in the war, the global war on terror, which has a lot of conceptual as well as operational problems. But it, you know, it clearly had nothing to do with, you know, going after the people who perpetrated 9/11.
Now, of course, the talk in Washington, as we said earlier, is all over the debt ceiling. Your book, you rip on all kinds of government bailouts, TARP program, car company bailouts.
The only bailout, you know, for small magazines of libertarian persuasion published by nonprofits, you know, that's...
Yes, you ripped on newspaper bailouts, I think,
oh,
too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You would, too, right? I mean, like, you don't want
the
Chronicle to go out of business.
I want the conflict of interest. Yeah. And as you put it, the U.S. can afford these programs because we are, quote, so out of money. So with people on both sides of the duopoly aisle saying that they fear that the U.S. will go into default, what would you do? Do you raise the ceiling? What do you do?
Cut spending and raise the ceiling, basically.
And you know, this is one of the things that's interesting is that we're focused on, and this is the way that kind of kabuki theater plays out. Oh, my God, we only have until, you know, it started. We only had until sometime in April or sometime in May and then maybe July and now August 2nd, might be August 10th, but we have this absolute drop dead deadline, and if we don't do something now, it's going to be worse than the Y2K problem. You know, it's like it's over, baby. And you know, the fact is that the debt limit is important, you know, and you got to deal with that. But to just raise it, as President Obama was talking about doing, and John Boehner had signaled early on that he was okay with that, but to raise it without any conditions is a problem, because the issue isn't the debt ceiling per se. It's that we have been on an unbelievable bender of spending in the 21st century that shows no signs of stopping. Standard & Poor's, which, God forbid, you use their ratings when you're buying any kind of bond that's a mortgage-backed security, but you know what they said is like, hey, you know what, yeah, it's great if you take care of the debt ceiling, but in 3 months, if you don't have a plan in place to trim $4 trillion in future deficit spending, you know, we're going to downgrade you. So this is really what it's about is, you know, what are we doing about the fact that we are persistently and increasing numbers spending a lot more money than we're bringing in? And we got to pull that. You know, that's the issue, and that's what we should be talking
about.
Do you
have a proportion or numbers, you know, like a 25% cuts and so what?
Well, I mean, a standard issue or, you know, an understanding is that since 1950, we have averaged, in terms of revenue as a percentage of gross domestic product or economic activity, it's been around 18%, despite every attempt to raise it or to lower it. I mean, it's just, it keeps coming pretty tightly clustered around there. We've been spending like 20%, and of course now we're spending, you know, because of the recession, receipts are at about 15% of GDP, and we're spending about 25%, so the gap grows, which is one of the reasons why you want to have a rainy day fund or, you know, some flexibility where we don't have that. But what we could do, Matt edited a spectacular article that was published earlier in the print this year in the print edition of the magazine, which was written by somebody named Gillespie and Veronique DeRougie, an economist. But we're just using basic estimates, the realistic estimates that the CBO puts out. In 10 years, we can expect to have tax revenue about 19% of GDP. How do we get there from here? And it's actually pretty easy. What you do is you compound small cuts of about 3.6% a year of each budget over time. And what that would mean is we're spending about $3.8 trillion now. We'd be spending about the same in 10 years as opposed to $4.7 trillion under Paul Ryan or $5.7 trillion under Barack Obama. And if we were spending $3.7 trillion in 2021, that would be about 18% of GDP, which is exactly the same percentage that we spent the last 2 years of Bill Clinton's.
Where would they come from? Where would the cuts come from?
Well, they would come. I mean, sorry, this is unfortunately, you know, I was talking in the green room. I started out being a teen magazine editor and a music magazine editor, and I can tell you right now, I'm wondering, as are you, what the hell did I do with my life? You know, I could have written the Corey Haim obit, and instead I'm talking about a different type of issue altogether. But, you know, you cut, the big money is in military, and it's in Medicare, and it's in Social Security. And it's not hard to find fat. We have doubled military spending, you know, basically since about 2001. We have nothing to show for it other than a lot of, you know, spent money.
And we have a number of departments in Washington, D.C. that we have to make a decision. Do you want, you know, even a shadow of the current kind of welfare state slash safety net entitlement programs, or do you really want a Department of Agriculture? I mean, it's really, we are out of money. You're going to have to make decisions. You're seeing it in California as the last Republicans are leaving the state, and the, you know, the Democrats are sitting around saying, all right, now who do we blame? I mean, that's why you had a pension reform that almost passed in San Francisco, because you're out of money. You got to do something, and this is going to cost, you know, it's the word unsustainable, and I hate the word sustainable in most contexts, but the word unsustainable is being used by people like Barack Hussein Obama and Ben Bernanke talking about our current trajectory, just on what we're going to have to pay for 10 years from now. So if you're not talking about making a hard decision right now, you're a problem. And that goes for citizens as well as politicians at this point. So, you know, if you like all the nice, fancy, you know, if you want your big fast bullet train to nowhere in the middle of the Central Valley for some reason, okay, great, but you're going to have to give up a pension system. You're going to have to do something. So there are a lot of programs in Washington, you know, get rid of all agricultural subsidies right now. You know, let poor farmers sell us stuff and start making these kind of hard decisions.
Continuing on that, in the book you say virtually always in the United States, things have been getting better and better over the past 30, 40, or 50 years. But that's not true for everybody. Now, there's very little said in your book about the poorest Americans. And Saturday I was working on a story in the housing project here in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and I was thinking about you guys in the book, and what would that, the families there, what would their lives look like without any government subsidies? So what do you do about folks who live in the depths of poverty, you know, the permanent underclass? Mm-hmm. How do they get help?
Well, you know, one of the things, and this shows you where libertarians, you know, have their issues and whatnot. We believe in a governmentally provided social welfare, you know, safety net. And one of the things is that
not every libertarian does. In case that's not clear out there.
But you know, and probably. Because private organizations have been doing it and generally can do it better because they're more responsive to the needs both of the people are giving money to, as well as the donors who are, you know, want results as opposed to bureaucracies. But, you know, for the poor, here are the things. One is that you want a vibrant economy because it is true. You know, and being poor now, it's never good to be poor, but it's better to be poor now than it was in 1970, you know, by any kind of material measure. But you get rid of things like a public school monopoly that is designed, even if we spend more money on inner city schools, and in many places we do than we, you know, in better schools, those schools are designed to keep people poor. They're not there for the kids. They're there for the people who run them. I mean, it's like a prison, really.
Right. You guys
introduce radical school choice and let people get out of that and give them a head up. Get rid of the drug war, which doesn't do anything other than focus, dysfunction and, you know, police brutality and weirdness or lack of police attention in certain areas and punishes people in all sorts of ways.
And it's an excuse for police to harass unfavorable communities, period. And if you don't think so, I recommend everyone look at some of what the ACLU has been measuring in New York City about stop and frisks there, which something like on the order of 4 or 5 to 1, the people who are stopped and frisked for what to see whether they have marijuana are black. And black people in New York do not smoke pot one bit more than white people do. It's a way of how can I get a collar, a bust, cite somebody. That's what these laws do on the books right now that criminalize all kinds of behaviors.
I mean, so those are a couple of immediate ways to kind of, you know, to help the poor or help restructure American society so it's not rigged against the poor. The other thing is
But you would keep a social safety net. You would keep
well,
some sort
this
of entitlement.
Is the other thing is, no, it's not an entitlement, but and if we got rid of Medicare and Social Security or instead said, you know what we're going to do is we are going to help people who are indigent, who can't care for themselves because of some impairment, or who are kids whose parents can't take care of them, old people who need help. That is one thing. We don't have that. And Medicare and Social Security and most entitlement programs go to serve the middle class and the wealthy. They're bad at that. I mean, you know, if you think about it, if you're young and you could have been taking 12.4% of your wages and investing that for your retirement, you would retire on minimum wage in a pretty good situation as opposed to what you get with Social Security. There's no reason that Medicare, you know, just because you turn 65, you should get free or reduced, medical care. You know, that's wrong. If we got rid of these programs or changed them drastically, we'd be able to reduce the overall tax burden, which would help things flourish, and we'd have more money and time to focus on helping people who actually need help as opposed to...
So means testing them by income.
Yeah, or and getting rid of, these entitlements. I think, and this is one of the things that it really since the book has been published, we've been talking about this more, but entitlement, the entitlements that we're talking about, Social Security and Medicare, They are creations of the New Deal and of a Depression era mentality, even though Medicare is kind of like the last great act of the New Deal. Harry Truman was the first recipient of Medicare. He got the first Medicare card, and that was a symbolic thing. We live in a different America. We live in a different world, and we don't need that the way that we did. Seniors are not, more likely to be below poverty than above it, as they were even into the 60s. We need a rethink of this just in the same way. We don't need a bullet train. We don't need trains anymore for passengers the way that we might have in the 19th century. And we don't need Depression era entitlement programs for the 21st century. That's ludicrous.
I don't know if you saw a story in Sunday's New York Times. There was a piece that talked about taxing soda. I was like, no.
Yeah, sure.
I know you guys would love this. But
and just, for some of you, you might call it pop. I don't know.
Pop. That's what we call it, the pop back. Which, and this was considered here in San Francisco, as folks know.
That was one of the more sane ideas under Gavin Newsom, right?
Just to right around with
soda,
plastic bags.
As opposed to eradicate it. He had eliminationist rhetoric against soda.
So now this study in this story said that a penny per ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages would generate at least $13 billion a year in income.
And I think it would create or save 2.5 million jobs, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And you know what's great is it would trim.
The Giants would repeat as a World Series champion. How many times have you seen on a local story, and I'm sure this happens even in the San Francisco Chronicle, of like, actually, this community center, this arts, this poetry workshop over here, that creates or saves kind of a multiplier effect. Every dollar you spend here creates $5 worth of jobs. I mean, people are just pulling stuff out of their assholes. I'm sorry. It is nonsense, and this is nonsense. There's actually been economic studies of this that come from people who aren't involved activists who are trying to pass stuff, and they rubbish all of this. I mean, it's like sports. It's like corporate welfare for stadiums. Like, oh, this is going to generate a trillion jobs if we just spend $700 million on a baseball stadium in Washington, D.C. Well, like, no, actually. It's going to destroy a neighborhood. You're going to use eminent domain to screw over a bunch of people, usually poor people, usually minority people, and it's not going to do a damn bit for economic development. It's retarded, and I'm tired of hearing about it.
We're probably more in favor of taxing stupid New York Times columns that would raise a lot more than $13 billion.
Now, here's what I want to run this by. I knew you would love this one. But the author, Mark Bittman, who is incidentally the author of How to Cook Everything.
That's right.
Yeah. He's a very good food columnist.
He's a very good food columnist.
I'm sorry that he's writing op-eds. Yeah.
He said, quote, the food industry's mission is not public health, but profit. So they'll continue to sell the health-damaging food that's most profitable until the market or another force skews things otherwise.
Right.
That other force should be the federal government fulfilling its role as an agent of the public good and establishing a bold national fix. I think the federal government has any role. He pitches this as a cost saving. It could save $344 billion by 2018.
I think it's 344.5 billion. They've really got it down.
But
to
what
the
is
science.
Seriously? What is the federal government's responsibility here? Do they have any responsibility for public health?
No.
Well, public health, for actual public health, not this thing that we now call public health, which is a way to tell people who live in South Central LA that they can't open a fried chicken stand, which is really where we've gotten in this country, which is racist. I'm just going to say it. It's racist. You're telling people in Southern California, in South LA, which is a minority community, you unlike the people who live up in Hollywood, you can't really handle a fast food joint because you're not making good choices. So we're going to make the choice for you. I'm sorry. I mean, that's not the position of what government should be doing.
How about the tobacco industry? You know, mm-hmm. there's so much regulation on tobacco. You can't where you can smoke, what you can smoke, all this stuff.
You got to make sure that you're getting your tobacco farm subsidy properly. You got to file those papers right. I mean, this is one of the ludicrous things is the government is working this from every possible angle.
But smoking has dropped in half.
What's interesting is there's no question the tobacco industry lied about a lot of stuff, you know, and they knew that, and like everybody else, my father, who was born in 1923, we were practically twins, as a matter of fact. I was born just about 12, 13 months before him. But, I mean, he was telling me that, you know, in the 30s and 40s, they called them coffin nails. Everybody knew smoking was bad for your health. Ronald Reagan and Jackie Robinson and a bunch of other people who advertised them for the great pep they gave you, notwithstanding. But, you know, the tobacco company lied about stuff, and they should be held accountable for lying about that. The government, you know, it's not such a bad thing that the Surgeon General published a report. It's also not exactly clear how much that was the major cause. Was that a leading indicator of why people stopped smoking, or is it also a lagging indicator where people became a lot more health conscious? I mean, we drink less than we used to, or spirits and whatnot, than we did 40 years ago. Yeah. I'm saying in the aggregate, Matt. Obviously, Matt is plowing ahead with the, you know, he's keeping rye subsidies alive. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. But this is the question: do we want the government saying, you know what, you can't have Yoo-hoo? Yoo-hoo is bad for you. Whole milk is bad for you. Soy milk is good for you. Tobacco is bad. You know, that isn't what it's about. And what the problem with public health stuff is that if you start socializing healthcare and the cost of healthcare, then you do say to the government, you know, yeah, you have a role. If we're all in this together because we're sharing the same healthcare system, then you're going to have people telling you how to live. And that's not a good way to go.
And not to sound like a crazy libertarian about this, but the logical conclusion to that, just like we're always asked about the logical conclusion of you don't want to have a government sidewalk kind of thing, but is that federal agents with guns and search warrants go to raw milk producers who are Amish living in the Pennsylvania countryside, and they say, you know, you pour that out or you're in big trouble.
And don't the Amish have enough problems?
Yeah. I mean, no, that is what is happening in the America that we live in now. So it's hard for me to get excited about, you know, of trying to justify why, you know, I might think in theory that it's bad to impose a restaurant smoking ban. That's all well and good, but, you know, we're totally losing that fight. And in the meantime, we're all kind of losing fights in terms of just normal freedom to buy and sell stuff and produce stuff without people with guns showing up at your door.
In the book, you sing the praises of deregulating industries. A particular success story was Southwest Airlines, mm-hmm. and which was able to thrive after the airline industry was deregulated. Bless you. But what about wondering about like the FDA, in particular about food safety? Where does the role of government come in? Something like that.
This goes back to the Mark Bittman column about, you know what, Coca-Cola is thinking, how can we plump up humans and kill them and make more money that way? You know, it's, you know, food businesses by and large are not in the business of poisoning their people or saying, you know what, we have a lot of fecal matter in our material. Would you buy our chicken? You know, it doesn't work that way. And, you know, at the restaurant level, it's, you know, word of mouth is a lot more important than food food inspectors come along may or may not be on the take. There's always a lot of problems with that. You know, you don't need that, but this is one of the things about libertarianism. People say, well, if the government doesn't do it, nobody will. You know, the fact is why wouldn't there be multiple certifying organizations that go around to certain types of food preparation or food processing plants that might say, hey, you know what, they butcher their meat in a particular way and they actually follow it down to the letter of the law and maybe we'll call it kosher or something. I mean, there are any number, or we'll say this is fair trade and this is free trade and this is Harvest Mark, which traces produce from the source to the shelf of a grocery store. There are all kinds of regulatory systems that businesses would create in order to add value to their products and to certify for things that the customers really want, to say, you know what, this was raised this way. as opposed to just saying the FDA, which is going to look at food safety and then is also going to do stuff for medicines and keep people from getting life-saving medicines, even if they're already secured and they've been used in other parts of the world without any problems, et cetera. Yeah. No, this is, competing regulatory regimes is not a bad thing because then, there's more than one rating agency. You can Underwriters Laboratory and various competitors for electrical products, this type of stuff.
But that's the industry regulating itself.
No, it isn't. Because it's no more than, it's no more than the way in which universities get accredited by different agencies or, whatnot. The only way that these ratings matter in a way that customers will use in order to, and that companies can use in order to get more money and show more value to customers is if they're really tough on it.
And again, let's talk about how this works in practice. Reason TV, which Nick is the editor of, we do all these documentaries, and we're talking to people who sell bacon dogs on the streets of LA. Again, generally minority immigrants, whatever, and talk to people who've been thrown in jail for 180 days for selling bacon dogs. And we asked the person who was enforcing this in City Hall, like, who complained? Who got sick? It's like, well, but people could get sick here. So there's not a single customer complaint. There is no one throwing up in the streets. But we just are terrified, and by we, I kind of mean everybody on some level, terrified of people having a transaction in which there is nobody there to no sort of like a mediating government force to approve it. And the logic of that is shutting down lemonade stands of seven-year-olds, which, again, we see it's not a myth. It's happening all over this country this summer. And it's, we don't know what's in the lemonade. Well, yes, you do. It's like lemon and sugar. It's not really complicated. I think that's what's in lemonade anyways. But.
We have time for a couple more quick questions, and we're going to go to audience questions. What about abortion? I know that's one that...
What do you need, cash or a check?
Yeah. We can talk off air afterwards. Okay. About 30% of self-identified libertarians, you say, support abortion rights. Oppose abortion rights.
Yeah, right.
But you say this isn't a litmus test for being a...
I'm not a big fan of litmus tests. I don't even like them for the presence of alkali. I find litmus tests are rigid. But beyond that, for libertarians, I think, the question is, when does life begin? I guess it is for everybody because nobody wants to say, that having an abortion of a fetus, at 2 days, nobody says, it's a fully formed person with absolute constitutional rights. So, it's okay to kill it then, but not after it's born. Nobody's talking that, but... I would rather say I support reproductive rights and I support abortion rights for women. In the country, we have come to a rough, it's not a logical or perfectly rational thing, but everybody is pretty much okay, including conservative Republicans, with abortions in the first trimester. As you get closer to birth, people get a little bit edgier about it. More important, though, is that we have to understand, the birth control pill, and this is a stat that Matt dug up for the book, which is just fascinating to me, the birth control pill, which kind of signals the modern age of us, particularly of women, taking over the reproductive processes, that was only made available to non-married women in, the early 70s. This is amazing. And abortion, which has been around for a long time, but... we're in the very early stages of this. Abortion is becoming less of a pressing issue, partly because of things like Plan B, which is not an abortion pill, but it's a super contraceptive pill people take after unprotected sex, and it stops implantation or fertilization from happening. We, within our lifetimes, probably within the question and answer period, these types of questions, and I don't mean to make light of it, but they are becoming less pressing as we gain more control over our bodies, and that's a good thing, and it also scares the hell out of a lot of people.
I am the opposite of a social conservative in every way, shape, and form, and I'm easily irritated by people who try to sort of inflict their social conservatism onto public policy. And all of that said, of all of the issues that I have, at least an intellectual respect for, even if I disagree with it, it's anti-abortion. from the perspective and from the libertarian perspective, libertarians are obsessed with individual rights vis-a-vis the government. And so if someone in their brain sees that individual right adhering to a one-hour-old fertilized egg, I think it's kind of weird. I don't agree with it, but I understand where they're coming from in a way that I absolutely do not for one second understand opposition to gay marriage, for example. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Nick, same thing on gay marriage?
Yeah, so Matt and I are going to be going to New York later. It's a big surprise to our girlfriends and wives, but, you know. It's
good. But not our kids.
Yeah, that's right. No, they've known.
We are going to be taking, in about 5 minutes, we'll be taking your questions soon, so please start lining up at the microphones now. And that is, as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum. Connect your intellect. And tonight we're hosting What Would Libertarians Do with authors and Reason magazine editors Matt Welsh and Nick Gillespie. We have time for a couple more quick ones here. Now, your book is a very good critique of the current system. You're taking down everything from politics, also the media, and the healthcare system, education. But there's not a lot of solutions. And say, like, well, boy, I really agree with you guys. Where do I line up? Where can I sign up? Come on, let's get this done. Let's get some people elected. How does that happen?
Well, first of all,
how do you take that energy and turn it into electoral success?
I would be terrified of any movement that really listened to us for practical advice. What we talk about in the book is less, here's the party that's going to arise from the independents, and here are the elections they're going to win, and here's the dreamboat candidate that they're going to support. But it's more that the future of American politics is going to be much more like, and even if you hate them, the Tea Party, or the Howard Dean movement, what it could have been and what it did not end up being, in that it's going to be single issue based. What is a roadblock in current public policy, especially a roadblock that is perpetuated by both parties and disrespects a tradition within one of the two camps? So Tea Party arose because Republicans for 15 years had completely disrespected their kind of limited government Barry Goldwater gene. They'd stomped on it for a really long time. Howard Dean anti-war movement, similar story on some level. The anti-interventionist tradition on the left had been disrespected, I think, by Bill Clinton and who knows what John Kerry was besides saluting. And so this rose up, but but that movement then adhered to the Democratic Party. It got on the reservation. Howard Dean became the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. MoveOn.org adhered to the anti-war candidate Barack Obama. And as a result, right now, the anti-war left is in complete disarray, which is a real shame, I think. Tea Party has kept an arm's length from the Republican Party. They have said, we will nominate a crazy person who will lose to a Democrat.
And who unconvincingly claimed she was not a witch.
Yes.
Which thereby taking
not
away
to name names.
Yeah, taking away the last reason to vote for her, by the way.
But when suddenly your vote is no longer taken for granted, then people are going to pay attention to your single issue. And it's easier to find coalitions and ad hoc swarms of people. And I think we'll see that in the future, not again as a party to emerge, but as a single policy. And I would look in the future on the left with some people on the right helping out, specifically on the legalization of marijuana in California and Colorado and Nevada, hopefully as soon as 2012, as an issue that people will rise to the level of a single issue that's more important than some damn political party.
And let's talk about, aside from Ron Paul, Congressman from Texas, and maybe not even him.
Dr. Congressman Ron Paul.
When you look at the survey of the field of 2012 presidential candidates, is there anyone out there who sends a shiver up your leg?
You know, I haven't had feeling in my legs for like 10 or 15 years. But no, I'm a fan. I think Ron Paul is really interesting, and I think he was great, particularly in 2008. He brought a lot of different ideas to the national debate, which was good. In the current crop, I think somebody like Gary Johnson, the two-term former governor of New Mexico, who's a Republican who won and governed well in an overwhelmingly Democratic state, is an interesting guy, and I hope he gains some more traction, in the time to come. And, I think it would be great just to see, more people coming out with interesting ideas and interesting backgrounds, not... I didn't even really have to listen much to Herman Cain having had Godfather's Pizza and, right there. It's like, I think Papa John could give him a run for the money. Maybe he could be the vice president.
Okay, let's go to questions, ma'am. Question for our authors tonight.
Hi, my name is Babette Hogan. Thank you very much for writing this book and putting this out here for all of us to listen to and discuss. I guess my question would be primarily around the EPA, and are there any reasons why the libertarians versus the Libertarian Party, which is a whole other system that we can't really talk about necessarily in one question, but what's the libertarian position on the EPA, and is there a usefulness in regulating certain industries that, in fact, impinge upon our personal property rights and our community property rights?
So you're suggesting that you own your lungs, huh?
Yes.
That you're not just renting them. Do you want to take
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Southern California. I grew up in an area of North Long Beach where we couldn't see the mountains more than which were 20 miles away, 25 miles away, for something like, except for about 7 days out of the year. And now when I go back to my dad's house, we see it 330 days a year or something like that. You see it a lot more. The air quality is inarguably a lot better, and some of that is due specifically to emission standards and regulations that have happened. Of all of regulations that make some kind of intuitive sense to me, environmental regulations are really high or at the top of the list, because that's where my factory on my property emits something that goes to where you're sitting on your property. There is a legitimate property rights problem, a commons problem, and we've got to figure out how to get at that. So I don't know if I love the EPA. I'm sure that, you know, in my grubby, horrible hands, it would look a lot different or something. But I think we share water. There's ways that you can inject property rights insights into environmental regulation. It's something that we talk a lot about at Reason. But as a philosophical point of view, I understand the EPA a hell of a lot more than I understand the Department of Agriculture, for example.
And, you know, another way of talking about this is that, you know, there are areas that you need a political consensus, in place. National defense is one, I think, certain types of air quality standards. But the idea behind libertarianism is not to say none of that matters, but to squeeze it down to its bare minimum, because it's hard, and it forces a lot of people into uncomfortable and oftentimes inefficient situations. Another way of thinking about that is it's one thing for the EPA or the government to set standards that are agreed upon consensually. It's another one for them to mandate specific technologies which may not innovate or grow over time. So it was probably a good idea to get rid of leaded gasoline. That helped clear the air a lot. Not as good an idea to say, okay, you've got to use a particular type of catalytic converter in order to clean out certain types of emissions. Let more experimentation and innovation go, even in the areas that are top-down controlled. Nobody believes that. Yeah, I mean, even the environmentalists.
Ask a question, go up and line up so we keep things a little order. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting What Would Libertarians Do with authors and Reason Magazine editors Matt Welsh and Nick Gillespie. Next question, sir.
Hi, my name is Reed, and considering your guys' definition of libertarianism as conservative or fiscally conservative, just touching on TARP and the Recovery Act, after the bubble burst, and I guess it was fall of 07, and then the recession intensified and throughout 2008 leading up to the election, I guess my question would be two parts. Do you believe that without the Recovery Act and TARP, that the private sector, without that aid in the government, the recession would have been able to pull itself out and would not have fallen into a depression? Mm-hmm. And what would have been your method to alleviate that problem?
It's the great unknowable or unfalsifiable, and it gets bumped up. You know, it wouldn't have just been a depression, but it would have been the depression to end all depressions kind of thing. I believe, but it's only a belief because we can't know, that if you would have allowed people who made bad bets and bad decisions to go bankrupt, that if you would have rejected the notion of too big to fail as scaremongering by Goldman Sachs, which it was on some level, and you know, maybe some of it was honestly felt by a variety of people, and you would have said, how can we get, for example, the government out of the business of guaranteeing 99% of new mortgages written in this country, and allowed the real estate market to actually clean its toxic assets out and find a bottom, I think we'd be a lot better off than we are now. And where we are now is consistently exceeding all worst-case scenarios that were offered at the time for what would happen if we didn't pass their panicked new legislation, whether it was TARP or the stimulus or the omnibus, which we've already forgotten, or George W. Bush's stimulus, which we've also already forgotten. Every one of these things was like, oh, if we don't pass the stimulus, I think unemployment might get as high as 8.8%. We kind of have shot through that. And, you know, not to say that we're always right about everything, but in the process of all of these things, we said, we don't believe that this spending program is going to work. We're going to say, put our names on the record that that is actually a bad idea, that Keynesianism stimulus is not a winner. There's only like one example from history where you can say it might have worked, but it's kind of disputed, whereas there are many examples of cutting the size of government in tough times, like after World War II in America or in New Zealand in the 80s or Canada in the 90s, where you cut the size of government in the teeth of a potential recession, and lo and behold, it worked out. So I think you have to get the government out of the mortgage business ultimately, and you have to let the work of capitalism work, which involves and requires failure and bankruptcy, which is different than liquidation entirely.
And strangely, you know, those of you who are old enough to remember the late 80s and early 90s when Japan was going to take over the world and certainly over the United States, then went into a prolonged slump was called the Lost Decade, which is now, it's proven so popular, it's entering its second Lost Decade. We are pursuing exactly the same policies where we are refusing to let markets fall to the bottom so that the economy can restart. And it's always couched in terms of like, oh, it'd be too catastrophic, too disruptive. And instead what you do is a slow bleed, because housing prices always do come down. Asset prices do come down to where the market thinks they're really valued. You can either do that quick or slow and make it much worse and stretch it out over time. In an area like Silicon Valley, when the tech bubble burst, that was a massive phenomenon. What is stunning about it is that there was no government reaction. Nobody said, you know what, we got to save pets.com, because otherwise, you know, there's a lot of sock puppets. Jesus Christ, we don't want them wandering the streets. And, you know, what that meant was there was an intense contraction and a quick restart. So,
do you feel that?
Now I think you have allotted your question. I'm sorry.
You can talk to the fellows afterwards.
Yeah,
in fact, we've all exhausted. Unfortunately, we're all exhausted our time here. Oh no, we have 10 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry, I misread 10, your last sign.
Yeah.
Next, yeah. Sir.
Go ahead. Hi, my name is Jim, and I was just wondering. Over the past 15 years, the increase in, you know, the poor people getting poor and wealthier people are getting wealthier, the gap between those two has increased greatly. I was wondering, how is that an effect of this duopoly of parties, and how can libertarianism fix that problem?
Are poor people getting poorer?
Yeah, I mean, in absolute terms, they are not, certainly.
In comparison, the wealth gap between the wealthy and the poor is
getting
larger.
Different.
Yeah, very different.
And it's an important difference to point out. The median income adjusted for inflation in America in 1970 was $15,000 a year or something like that. Now it's $27,000 a year. We've had a huge, you know, increase in spread of income inequality since then, but that's different than poor people getting poor. And I think it's a consistent misnomer about trade, about capitalism in general, that it looks for somebody to get under its shoe and to make even poorer than they were before they started trading and having factories and such like that.
Yeah, I one of the questions, and inequality bothers a lot of people, and I have to say, as somebody who's not nearly high enough up on the income pyramid as I deserve to be, as my parents told me I should be, as every woman I've ever dated has told me, the fact is there's a huge amount of income mobility and socioeconomic mobility in America, and we trot out some studies in the book as well as stuff that came out subsequent to the book by Pew, which is a vast, great resource online for all sorts of things. But intergenerational mobility is still pretty strong. People go up and people go down. It's actually kind of a humane system in that there's something of a ratchet effect where it's a lot easier to move up the ladder than it is to fall back down. We're never going to have a perfect distribution where everything is even or whatnot. And I think ultimately that that's the wrong focus to have. The real question is opportunity out there, and is the baseline existence for people getting better not judged upon like what Bill Gates has or Steve Jobs has, but rather where they were or what their parents were encountering or what might have been 10 years ago. And in that sense, when you look at the opportunities, generally speaking, if you start out poor, you still have more access to things like cars, to owning houses, to higher education than you did in the past. And that's a good thing, and that's mostly an outcome of a vibrant economy, not of specific government programs.
And I think one of the more underreported stories in kind of global life over the last decade is that 500 million people have been lifted out of poverty in India and China. That's a good thing, right? We like when people are no longer poor. And it's not because they had a kind of closed economy. It's precisely the opposite. It's because they traded with the world and started joining the kind of exchange there. I want more people to come out of poverty.
Thank you.
Next question for Matt and Nick.
Hi. Earlier you mentioned that on some issues there's just a definite need for consensus. And one of those that occurred to me, and I was wondering if the book touched on this at all, is there something that you would say is the proper future trajectory of monetary policy looking forward?
Yeah, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, this is, I can tell you, I was editor-in-chief of the magazine from 2000 to 2008, and I can remember one of my staffers in like 2005 saying, you know, I really want to do a story about the Fed, and, you know, just why do we even have it? It's a, you know, disaster. And I was like, come on, nobody cares about the Fed. And, you know, that was one of many instances where I thought that Hurricane Katrina was going to be like a weekend, a 72-hour story. It didn't quite turn out that way. In terms of the Fed policy, I mean, there's two things that are interesting to think about. Central banks have less power now than they had 50 years ago because, you know, it's harder for countries to try and, you know, kind of wall off their currency from a global economy. They can't distort their currency as much as they once were. So that's good. On another level, we have a Fed here, and this is also true of other countries, where the Fed has been very aggressive in terms of dictating its monetary policy. It's supposed to be independent. We know that that's not really quite true. And I think one of the things that people like Ron Paul, along with people like Dennis Kucinich, I mean, kind of right and left, talking about auditing the Fed and getting a better understanding of things is a good idea. I'm a big fan of, we were talking in the green room about Bitcoin, just as a demonstration project of a virtual currency, but the idea of a kind of, you know, that you have a stable increase in the monetary supply that is predictable and regular, and that would kind of take out of the political gaming of the money system that would help alleviate a lot of the kind of weird bubbles that a central bank can cause.
Yeah, for those who aren't versed in sort of intra-libertarian philosophy debates, there are various strong wings, and in Austrian economics specifically, the Federal Reserve and central banking is just a fundamental kind of root cause of a lot of things. Once you have a kind of governmental central bank, then that allows you to debase the currency to fund wars and to fund the endless growth of government. And it's been a focus. And I'm kind of like with Nick. In 2007, I would see Ron Paul talk about the Federal Reserve and the gold standard. And I wouldn't necessarily roll my eyes, but I thought to myself, this is not going to catch on. And I swear to God, you go on college campuses and you're going to get some end the Fed chants these right. days. So my days of being kind of skeptical or dismissive of that are long behind me. And I think it's really interesting. And there are people, I know journalists who cover the Federal Reserve who aren't libertarian remotely. And they say, thank God for Ron Paul, because he has injected a sense of accountability, or just the first little foot in the door of, you know, let's have some audits of this stuff.
It's also, I mean, not to go on and on about this, but it's also true that, you know, economic exchange ultimately, I mean, you use currency in it and whatnot, but it's really the fundamentals. You know, the Fed can screw around with stuff or any central bank, but in the end, it's really the larger government policy. So, you know, if the housing bubble is at the center of our financial problems and our fiscal problems, it isn't really about whether or not the Fed had, I mean, to a certain degree, it's about having loose monetary policy or low interest rates and keeping them low that allowed people to buy more houses than they would have otherwise. But more importantly, it's the idea that you're subsidizing people's risk in the end, and it doesn't matter what the monetary policy was. That's a bad idea. When you sever economic behavior, when you sever risk-taking from responsibility, it's bad things are going to happen in whatever you're using.
Next question for the authors.
Great. Hi, guys. Nice to see you again. Maybe you could play devil's advocate for me, just for a moment. I guess
why don't you get a job? You're going to wear that?
I don't get that joke. And I want to. But, okay. I really do want to. It'll be kind of unsatisfying to play devil's advocate because if you do a good job, you'll end up making an argument you know, that you don't support, nonetheless. You know, when I'm thinking about the Commerce Clause and the decisions that I've seen, and the laws that I've seen passed in the Supreme Court decisions, was it Gonzales v. Raich, I think?
Right.
Yeah. To me, I can't see an interpretation of the clause that is either one that says, you know, that there is a limited power for the federal government to intervene in commerce, you know, limited to a bunch of special spheres that involve trade between states, and just a vacuous interpretation that says they can just do anything.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the establishment, which is a nebulous term, has a third interpretation, or if they're just if they just think it means anything. It's vacuous.
Well, I mean, you know, the Commerce Clause has come up in the context of particularly the individual mandate in the Health Care Reform Act. There is no question that kind of broadest possible interpretation of the Commerce Clause, which really dates back to the New Deal, mm-hmm. the attempt to really kind of stretch it to cover anything, is what Congress uses to, you know, justify everything that they do. It seems to me that a fairly plain reading of the Commerce Clause is simply that, you know, states can't really restrict trade among the states, and that it's better off when, you know, that is the correct reading and the one that is held up in the courts. I don't know that that's a particularly satisfying
answer. You're talking about the mentality of people who use it as an ever-expansionary thing, or what are they thinking about? They're thinking that they got away with it, and that enough water has passed under the bridge, or legislation has been passed, using the Commerce Clause as kind of a crutch or whatever, that it can't be challenged, because to do that would depart so far from our modern notion of legislation making, which is why this is going to be a super fascinating Supreme Court decision, because it's going to be 5-4 one way or the other, and it might, and it's a project of libertarian legal scholars, it might actually come out with a more narrow definition of the Commerce Clause, which would be super controversial because it's in the context of Obamacare, and people will say that it's just, you know, right-wing corporate lackeys once again. But there's a very interesting long legal history that that has to do more in terms of, you know, of a great and interesting kind of jurisprudence question. So we live in interesting times.
All right. Thanks.
Well, we did until this forum. And for that, we apologize.
Yes.
Guys, we're now asking all of our speakers the following question. Matt, Nick, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
Stop having the notion that you have a 60-second idea that can change the world would be my first one. No, seriously. Yeah. I mean, everyone's looking for a silver bullet. Nick can probably bore you with a Whole Foods panel he was on with a variety of healthcare food health nuts about various things. If he just all stopped eating meat, we would create 35 billion jobs and solve global warming. It's like, stop it already. The human race and all of what we're doing and the robots that you guys are all building over next door, we're kind of muddling through, and it's getting better, and it doesn't feel like it's getting better, but it is. We're kind of 1,000 trillion billion transactions are happening at any given time. That is kind of moving the ball forward. I am more interested in that, making the world better than someone's got a 60-second idea that's going to make it all work.
I think, you know, I want to leave you, I guess, with three kind of Zen koans too, or I don't know, the Zen koans, I guess, which synagogue do they go to? But,
40 seconds.
But, you know, three things to ponder. One is that Christian rock is neither. Another is that real winners do use drugs. And then the final thing is that you can't abort your fetus with nuclear arms.
And, all right. Let's give a big round of applause to Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Take it, my friend. Send us out with three bangs. Yes.